Okay, this is Rob Chase, and I'm running for 4th District Legislature in Washington State.
Yeah, you served as county treasurer for a couple of terms, so you've had some elected officials experience.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I served 8 years as county treasurer, and this is my 7th race.
So I think I may have asked you this before, but tell me the story of how you got into this race. Why did you decide to run for the legislature this year?
Well, I started out, I had decided to run against Kathy McMorris. And my reason being that I believe in term limits and not like the contract with America of 3 terms, but I think 12 years is plenty for anybody to be in a position. And I believe in rotation in office is healthier for a republic. Kathy, I think, was going on her 9th term, 18 years. So I thought it was time for a change. I ran against George Nethercutt in 2002, so I kind of had that experience, and I've feel strongly about that America is going down the wrong path. Kathy is in a very important position, to make a lot of change that needs to be made, and it didn't seem like she was doing very much.
So why choose the legislature? What kind of a difference can you make in the legislature?
Well, actually, going back a little bit, what happened was I was all set to run against Kathy. I'd put up my little signs, in every county in the 5th District, and had put, quite a bit of money into it. And but with the COVID thing, it didn't seem like, anything was, people's attention was there. But on May, early May, I got a call from Matt Shea, my 4th District representative, and he wanted to meet with me. And to cut right to the chase, he said some people were wanting him to run against Kathy McMorris, and they would back him. And if I would step out, then I could run for his position in the 4th. So that made sense to me. I always wanted to serve, and I would have a lot better running for state legislature than I would against Kathy McMorris. I think it only raised a couple $1,000, and Kathy had at least $2 million. So the odds weren't in my favor. But the nice thing about that is that you actually have a bully pulpit where you can say things. And my motto is truth matters. So I think there's a lot of things that aren't transparent that we need to know more about. So you suddenly kind of have to go through a complete mind twist. Okay, I was running for Congress, and these are the issues. Now I'm running for state legislature, and these are different issues. But still, I think truth matters, and I was running as a Trump Republican, and that was because Trump, at least wanted to make America great again. But I think, we can do that also through our state legislatures as well as in Congress too. So I'm like I said, I've been a 4th District resident since 1985, a Spokane County resident since Expo 74, when I came here from Kellogg. And I've been an activist for about 25 years. And like I said, this is my 7th race, so I know the routine. And I kind of enjoy running. I enjoy being able to speak about the things that I want to speak and actually to tell the truth, wherever I can see it. And so when I was county treasurer, I did go to Olympia quite a bit, quite often. I was successful in getting legislation passed. And, there's other things that I would like to get passed too, if I can get there and, be part of that group instead of just, be another lobbyist that comes over there. I can actually be one of those people that I, if I can do things right and find consensus and work across the aisle and all that, I think we can get good things done, especially when the needs are so high. We need to, with the whole COVID thing, the dust hasn't settled yet, so we don't quite know where we're at on revenues and what the future is going to look like for Washington State.
So you mentioned things you want to get done. Let me ask you for a quick bullet point list on that.
Okay, well, I want to get rid of, as county treasurer, I wanted to get rid of the penalties on property tax and just have a simple 12% interest on people that get behind. I fought for that for several years. I did get partial payments, any amount at any time, so people could fit that to their budgets, instead of just twice a year. So Spokane County is still the only county that is doing that, but I needed to get legislation passed in order to do that. So if you get behind, it's 12% interest, but the 2nd month you're behind, it's another 3% penalty on top of that. And the 9th month, it's another 8% penalty on top of that. So you're paying 23% in the 1st year. And these people, they're not doing it, out of being nefarious or anything. They get behind, you know, through life circumstances. So I think 23% is usury, and government is supposed to be actually trying to help the residents, not, you know, throwing them an anchor when they're drowning.
What are your expectations if you win this office? What does that look like for you as to how you would carry out being a state representative?
Well, I love my favorite things to work on are common cause issues. And I think, you know, getting rid of the penalty on property tax should be one. For instance, when I went to my treasurer's conference, I was the only one who wanted to allow partial payments. And so I lost 38-1. All the other county treasurers voted against me. But when it got on the floor, it passed 100%, you know. So, things like that are great. And I made a lot of friends, you know, on both sides, of people that came to my office that had been behind on their property taxes. And also I used my county treasurer position, you know, as a bully pulpit. So I was against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I made friends across the aisle. And we, went to Kathy McMorris and the two senators and city councils and everything we could do. And then President Obama was for it, but so were most of the Republicans, and like the Chambers of Commerce, you know, and everything. So I don't think they realized that we would have lost a lot of American sovereignty and a lot more manufacturing jobs if that had gone through. But we kind of lost, actually Trump ended it, I think, on his first day, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is, I think, what a good thing he did do when he got in there. And another one was Avista. You know, Avista wanted to sell out to Hydro One in Canada, and I could see no benefit to the county or the ratepayers of that. So I used my office as treasurer as a bully pulpit again, and I filed coordination against the Utilities and Transportation Commission. Coordination is comes out of the 1978 National Environmental Policy Act, where anything agency is going to do something that's going to affect the local area, they have to coordinate with the elected officials. And they had bypassed that completely. So I've sued them to come back and coordinate with us. Well, one of the reasons, too, was no one is going to come out of that. There's a possibility that our rates could have tripled. And those are people across the aisle. The CPAs I talked to, you know, penciled it all in, looked at the plans. And yeah, this could very well happen. But the main thing was the only people who were going to come out were the 13 board members of Avista, who were going to split $51 million 13 ways, and the shareholders of Avista, too. So that would actually affect our tax base. So I felt I had standing if companies don't move here or even stay here because rates are so high. So that was another thing I was able to do, a common cause thing. But of course, then Avista donated $100,000 to my opponent for my commissioner race 2 years ago. So I got outspent, you know, when all was said and done, 10-1. But, you know, I've enjoyed the last 2 years. You know, I've sold my house, and we're still staying in the 4th District. And I still want to bloom where I'm planted, which is here in the 4th District. So I've getting politically involved and everything is actually, I've made a few enemies, but I've made a lot more friends.
So you used the notion of truth matters, and I guess that was as part of your campaign against Kathy McMorris Rodgers. Is that aimed at Kathy McMorris Rodgers, or is it more of a general statement?
No, actually, I think Kathy's it was indirectly, wasn't like I particularly was going after Kathy on anything. I think she could be a lot more effective, but there's a lot of things that need to come out. For instance, Michigan State did a study on the budgets of the Department of Defense and also HUD. And they found $21 trillion missing. And what happened in response to that was they shut down all the websites that they got that information from and said it was classified from now on. So I think, you know, Congress needs to, you know, at least get into stuff, because I ran against George Nethercutt in 2002. At that time, the debt, the United States debt officially was $6.2 trillion. And even then, I thought that was pretty terrible. We never went over a trillion until the Reagan administration. But now suddenly it's 20 years later, and it's officially $27 trillion. And our country's insolvent. You know, how do we get that? How are we going to come back to that? We could never pay off that debt. So we need people to come in here and let we the people know, because I don't think they really know. I don't think they're being informed by the Fourth Estate or journalism very well on a lot of things that they should know more about.
So you talked about Matt Shea encouraged you to run for his seat. Mr. Shea is kind of a polarizing sort of figure. How are you different than Mr. Shea? How are you similar to Matt Shea?
Well, I'm similar. We're both conservatives. I think we would do some things differently. They always say, well, you're an extremist, you know. Well, what does that mean? How can Matt Shea be an extremist when he gets 58% of the vote in the 4th District? I mean, the whole 4th District must be extremist, you know. But I think that 30 years ago, we probably would have been in the center of the bell curve. And now I think both parties have moved so far to the left, limited government and property rights. Having those views seems to be more extreme than others. But actually, I was Matt Shea's first campaign manager in 2008. We've been friends all along. We have our differences, but we keep them between us and discuss them. You know, we don't go public on them, as happened. Matt is just one of those figures, almost like a sheriff, that's like a lightning rod for things. I'm probably a little bit more subdued, but that's just my manner, I think. But I think I am effective. I get things done, and I kept my word on my term limits pledge, you know, which I had faulted George Nethercutt for almost 20 years ago. So I think, you know, I'm predictable. I think, you know, truth matters. And if someone can convince me I'm wrong, you know, great. I want to be right.
Do you agree with Matt Shea's tactics, let's say at Malheur or the Church of Planned Parenthood and that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, I probably do. Looking at it, you know, it's fairly, especially the Malheur thing is fairly complicated, and so is the thing down at Bundyville. But, you know, some people, you know, when they take a vacation, it's on his own time, his own dime. He's very concerned about property rights. You know, if you don't have property rights, you soon lose the others. So it's a property rights issue. You know, those guys, their water rights and grazing rights were there before there ever was a BLM. So, you know, Matt Shea did that on his own time, you know, his own money. I mean, I plan on going maybe for a vacation to Cannon Beach or somewhere, but Matt loves that kind of stuff. So, you know, he goes down to Malheur, and I don't know how effective I would be. I mean, I'm an attorney like Matt was, so he probably had a better understanding of the issues there than I did.
So we're 7 to 8 months into the coronavirus. How would you grade the Governor Inslee and his administration on the response?
I'd give him maybe a D minus, I guess. I think he way overreacted to everything. I think the hidden costs that you don't hear about are probably worse than the COVID was itself. The hidden costs being all the businesses that have suffered from this and gone out of business, and the ramifications from that are lives ruined and divorces and suicides and, you know, all these social things that you don't see. All you hear about is, you know, the COVID virus. But when you look at the casualty rates or those who've contracted and those who have died, doesn't seem like any virus. I mean, we've had worse ones before this, but we never had to put masks on and mandated to have masks on and do the social distancing thing. So, you know, I think if we're going to make a mistake, it should be on the side of freedom. And the masks don't really work anyway. You see guys with beards, you know, sticking out wearing masks, and people with like almost rags, you know, with them on. So, you know, and then social distancing, I think people, you know, I see them, and I think they're all mostly pretty polite, you know, and keep their distance. If they see someone wearing a mask, it should all be voluntary. So Bob McCaslin, who's the other representative, and I, when we were campaigning, we doorbelled every business in the 4th District. And the consensus there was most of those people were pretty upset about it because their businesses were ruined, their revenues had fallen off, and a lot of those guys were just hanging on anyway. So I think I want to represent the people in the 4th District. In the 4th District, mostly what I saw was they thought it was an overreaction like I did.
Well, 200,000 people I don't think have died in a year from the flu in the past, I don't think.
Well, I think in 1917, of course, there was that huge pandemic that came through during World War I, I think. And I think if you adjusted the population, something I read, if you adjusted the population for what it is worldwide today, there could have been as many as, I mean, hundreds of millions of people that died during that. In fact, I think there's a million and a half people that have died worldwide from, not emphysema, but, you know, one of those other diseases that I can't think of right now, tuberculosis. And in fact, you know, looking at the average age of a person dying from COVID is 80 years old. And when you're 80 years old, up to those ages, you know, you don't have the antibodies, you're weaker. So these flus that come through every once in a while kind of carry some of them off. And that's just the human condition. You know, once you get closer to, you know, the end of your life years, you know, you get weaker fighting off things. But one of the other ramifications is I was listening to an interview yesterday, and there's a guy from, he has a mission at Sub-Saharan Africa, and he thinks that there's been hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of children that have died from malnutrition because the supply chains have been disrupted during the COVID lockdowns there too. So these are other costs you don't hear about. So, you know, maybe they were, Inslee was right, and the president was right to, well, we don't know, this is a weaponized virus that is out here. What's it going to do? So maybe precautions. Good, but I could tell. I mean, I thought it would be over by Easter, the precautions. Instead, it just seems to extend on and on. So we really won't know until all the dust is settled. But I think it's really hurt our state a lot worse than the COVID virus has.
So what do you think about the concept? I mean, the public health, I was going to ask you about the coronavirus has brought more attention to the role of public health in our society. Do you support more stable funding for public health, or do you think public health as an institution is not worth the money?
Well, I think I do public health differently. I think there should be more competition in public health with insurance companies. You know, I believe in having medical savings accounts that you can keep adding to, that you would, you know, the medical savings account itself would buy catastrophic insurance. You know, through those maybe higher premiums and that, and then out-of-pocket expenses. And it seemed also, you know, when I was a kid, before government really got involved in the whole health thing, is that, you know, if you got sick, it wasn't, you know, or injured, it wasn't bankruptcy you're looking at. You know, we were able to pay out-of-pocket stuff because, you know, there was more competition back in those days. In fact, I mean, I'm old enough, I remember the doctor coming to the house, you know, and, you know, giving us our little polio shots and everything. But, you know, ever since the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson, government has gotten more and more involved, and there's a direct correlation with it costing more and more, you know, to people. So then the government has to bail out. In fact, Medicare and Medicaid, you know, the other thing besides the national debt is all the unfunded mandates, you know, and, you know, we're looking at least $100 trillion that we owe into the future. And so it's an impossibility. Things have to change. So I think America, you know, was successful because it had free market capitalism. And by that, I don't mean crony capitalism, because, you know, Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. But I think there's also a medical-industrial complex, you know, because all the money that's been, you know, shoved that way has built that up. So I think there's a lot of things we have to rethink into the future for America.
So as a way of protecting people from losing their life savings due to a medical event out of their own, you know, how would you approach that as a legislator?
Well, I mean, that's what medical savings accounts, you know, you would have catastrophic insurance. And still, you know, there's charities, you know, people could actually don't. In fact, one idea I had, you know, how much revenues we're going to have a shortfall because of this coronavirus, but we have to think of ways to try to, you know, fund the important things, the things that add value to our state. So, you know, one of the things I was thinking of is, you know, why not, you know, have maybe the state treasurer's office have a website where people could donate to whatever they wanted to that the state runs. You know, maybe they could donate to Medicaid if they think it's underfunded out of their own pocketbook. You know, like President Obama said, you know, a few years ago, people that can afford to need to get more skin in the game, you know, so it'd be all voluntary. So it'd be interesting to see how well we were able to do that. Maybe they want to invest in the Husky and Cougar football coaches, or these other things that, you know, have the government things, or higher education, or K through 12, or whatever, all these other needs that they feel are underfunded.
Would that be instead of state funding, or to supplement state funding?
To supplement state funding.
Okay.
Yeah. But we don't know quite where we're going to be. We, you know, we're not going to have the revenue. So we have to start thinking, okay, how can we fill in the gap for things that are actually needed? Another idea I'm actually for, which is probably more popular amongst Democrats. I've been working with Senator Hasegawa on the concept of a state bank like North Dakota has. It would be a simple infrastructure bank. You'd have to have a firewall between the politicians, you know, and the bank itself. But when I was county treasurer, for instance, we invested, you know, we would collect taxes, but they wouldn't be needed by the county or the school districts or the fire districts, you know, for some time. And we actually had an investment fund that was $1 billion on average. So what North Dakota does, they use their those funds, you know, to build infrastructure. So they were actually able to, you know, help a lot of do participatory loans with businesses that had a project, but they couldn't help doing that. Because, you know, to create wealth, you need land, labor, and capital to do that. But also you need a catalyst, and that's credit, you know, to get going. So I think as maybe some of these banks are going to be going under, you know, we're at a huge bubble, you know, in bonds and stocks and real estate. So what goes up must come down. I learned that in 2008, you know, by watching everything. So eventually it can't keep going like it has been. There'll be a day of reckoning.
So let's move to a police reform. The state legislature is probably going to take up some reform legislation in 2021. And I'm curious as to what you think. Where is the proper governmental level for that discussion? Are those local discussions? Are they state discussions, a combination? And I'm talking about things like restricting chokeholds, bans on use of tear gas, accountability measures for police. How do you believe that?
Well, one thing I don't believe, we shouldn't defund the police. You know, that's just crazy. But everything's different. You know, the police force in Seattle, you know, has different challenges than, say, the police force in Kennewick or the police force in Millwood. You know, it's all kind of relative. But together, all these cities lobby and they tell you what they want, what they're behind. So you just kind of have to, you know, listen to everybody and make the best decision. You can also listen to the other legislators, the ones that are on those committees. They're experts in it, too.
I guess what you're saying is, I don't know yet what the answer is.
Right. Yeah, and I'll admit that. I don't know. I mean, I think there's definitely a need for police, but like locally, everyone's got a different, situation. For instance, when they had that city of CHOP or CHAZ or whatever it was on Capitol Hill, yeah, there was a guy who got a call from the morgue there and said, well, your son's here. He's dead. Someone shot him. And I mean, the poor guy, you know, he had to go down. His son was there. But who shot him? They didn't know. He was murdered. And you can't call the police. The police weren't around. They had been kicked out, you know. So, in fact, the only person who did call up and offer many condolences was President Trump, you know, to his credit. No one else did. So you got to have that accountability there that's there because there's a need for it.
Do you agree with the argument by some of the activists that police are often or sometimes go beyond their scope and murder black people?
Well, sometimes. I mean, there's tens of thousands of police around the country, and I know they have to go through a lot of training and all that, and I think it takes a certain type of person to become a successful policeman. So you're going to get a few bad apples through there, you know, and people change, you know, after they get there. Some of the policemen I know, they kind of trust each other, but they're kind of distrustful maybe of the public a little bit. So it's hard to overcome that, but you know, and you always have to be wise when you have a certain amount of power, which they do, and to be able to use that. And I think most of the policemen that I've met have gone into it, for the noblest of means. They want to help other people and serve that way.
Sheriff Gnezovich has talked about, you know, I can help solve this problem if you just allow me to get rid of the bad apples without having them bounce back at me through grievance procedures and that sort of thing. Do you agree with that?
No, I think there's a, you know, system already set up. I'm familiar with that. But, power corrupts, so you have to be very careful of that. And there's already, you know, there's police union and everything. You all kind of have to work together. So there's already, I think the bad apples will be identified. But nothing's perfect, you know. It's just, you admit the response to COVID. I mean, that's the human condition. You know, we're all have, you know, feet of clay and, you know, very various means, but we try to overcome that. You could say well thought out legislation. And if it's wrong, then, you know, it depends. You know, I'm open to listening to everybody. And if they can make the case, then I would support that for for things.
Sure. So we just got a couple of minutes left. I have two more questions for you. One, we looked like we were having a fairly easy wildfire season until Labor Day rolled in and the winds came in from the northeast. Should the state do more to prevent wildfires and fight wildfires? Should there be a dedicated fund for wildfires set up by the state?
Well, it seems like, you know, like a few years ago, it seemed like there, for many years, we didn't have any problem. I thought, you know, and then suddenly, I think in the, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, it was just terrible. And then we had like a couple of respite from, so it's hard to have some. I think we have probably pretty good response, you know. Now you're going to have some, you know, probably some casualties through quick wildfires that you can't do much about. But I think they've done a pretty good job. Now, the reasons for it, I've heard, at least from my side of the aisle, is forest management. You know, we've left a lot of places untouched, no logging and everything. Well, then the timber has built up. And I think, you know, before, naturally, you know, in 100, 200 years ago, in fact, you know, way back, that forests often, you know, they just burn, they're tinder, and every once in a while lightning strikes, they come through. In fact, I think, you know, even some of the Indians, you know, would do forest management here, you know, by lighting fires. And certain, understand, nuts from the pine trees or whatever don't actually burst open and germinate until there is these huge temperatures, you know, from fires. So it's a real challenge, you know, but there's people that are studying this. And also we have to look at entire budget, you know, what are our priorities? What's adding value? Is forest fires adding more value, you know, fighting them, or forest management, which has changed, you know, over the years. It seems like they're always changing in their beliefs. I have a friend who was in the Forest Service, my roommate from college for 4 years, changed quite a bit, just their methodology since he had been in there. So it's really hard to say. You know, you can get all prepared, put a lot of money into something, and then there's no forest fires. You know, you're never called out. So it's just a real challenge, but that's not my area of expertise.
Yeah. Do you agree with the notion that that some have had that these were climate fires rather than forest fires, just caused by much hotter weather over the last several years, drier conditions?
I've heard all that too. You know, if people don't quite the answer, it's fun to speculate. You know, what could it possibly be? Why are things different now than they were? So it's not an exact science. The science isn't, you know, finished on that. It's always going to be revolving. Climate change, and I'll get right into this. You know, the climate has always changed. You just have to look at, you know, glaciers and tree rings and all that. So, you know, at one time the Vikings lived in Greenland, and then they couldn't live there anymore. You know, so they always say, well, we got to have a carbon tax or whatever. But, you know, they used to joke that someday they'll tax the air that we breathe. And that's what I see a carbon tax is. So, you know, I'd always ask people, okay, how much CO2 is there in the atmosphere? And they never can answer that. So you can go to Wikipedia and find out the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere is 0.04%. And of that, 3% is, you know, probably going to be man-made. So if the atmosphere is 100 miles thick, it's only the last 68 feet that are man-made CO2. And we need CO2 to live. So I think, you know, fighting the whole climate change thing is kind of like fighting a flea on an elephant's back. You know, there's bigger fish to fry. You know, I think like plastic in the ocean, you know, I think that's something we should try to take care of. Maybe on our own. Maybe we can use those big aircraft carriers that are sitting there in Bremerton and, you know, and make them into recycling stations, you know, and get rid of that, because that's not a good thing. It's unnatural. Or Fukushima, you know, suddenly it's off. You know, it was real big, and now it hasn't gone away. It's still there. So we have a lot of things we need to do. Mostly, you know, it's taking care of ourselves. You know, I used to listen to the Art Bell show, and at one point, something he said really stuck with me. He said, you can't move away from it because there is no way. You have to deal with it, you know, and that's, I'm from Kellogg, and, you know, you could go out there and see all the tailings ponds and everything, and even though they put a veneer over, I think it's a lot better. It's still beneath the surface. So I think that's one of our big challenges is the environment. And I'd like to see maybe part of the Columbia Basin Project, if we can get that going, is to bring salmon back up to Spokane River.
I want to finish with you're asking folks for their votes, but you as a voter, what are the qualities you look at when you evaluate candidates and people to vote for?
Well, I think honesty and predictability. I may disagree with people, but at least if they're transparent, you know, you know what you're dealing with. You know, I think that's one thing that's important in any kind of business is predictability. So if I would probably vote for someone that I knew was being honest and someone who may be saying the things I like, but you can't really believe them, you know. And I found that out just by being an elected official, that there are a lot of people who know what to say to people, but they don't actually do it. So, you know, that's you just have to go by someone's background. Now, I made my my pledge, you know, for 2 terms. In fact, I had it do over again. I would have said 3 terms because I said like 12 terms, 12 years in any position is plenty, you know, because there's a correlation, I think, between you know, suddenly if someone's in office too long, they build their own ivory tower. You know, they're not really relating to the people. And they're effective, I think, more their first, you know, their first 4 or 8 years. But then the 12th year, there's certain things that need to be done, you know, too. But so, for instance, my term limit pledges, as you get older, they're easier to keep. Because, you know, I think it's 12 years. So I would do at most 6 terms, you know, 12 years if I kept getting reelected over and over again, as long as I could finish, unless I thought someone could do a better job than I could. By that time, heck, I'd be, you know, way up there in age.